Okay, a little test to measure how much you understand and appreciate biblical geography. Now, first of all, a word about the importance of this. Because the Bible's narrative is situated in the midst of world history, the place where that history occurred is part of the story, and more of a part than you might think. The Bible's history occurred in the ancient Near Eastern world of men and nations, and those people and those nations were profoundly shaped by their location, by the topography and the geography of the land in which they found themselves. Now, think about this in regard to your own nation's history. You cannot understand American history without understanding American geography. There are many things that are unique about the United States, or almost unique among the nations of the world, because of the place in which the nation is located. The size of the land, the difficulty of subduing it. You remember from school the insight of the American historian Frederick Jackson Turner. Fundamental to the American mind and to the American experience was the frontier. And the fact that the frontier was always moving westward. We were never content with the boundary, the border of the frontier, as it happened to be at any particular spot in our history. And things fundamentally changed when we got all the way to the Pacific Ocean and there was no frontier left. That was when we started having a lot more lawyers in the American world. But moving westward, feeling that we had what historians call a sense of manifest destiny to occupy the entire continent, or at least our share of that continent, fundamentally shaped the way Americans think about themselves, not only as pioneers, but as entitled. And much of this comes from our geography. And then think about the fabulous fertility of the land that God, for one reason or another, gave to us as Americans. The crops and the buffalo herds of the extraordinarily fertile Great Plains, the precious metals of the Western Mountains. Why was there a battle of the Little Bighorn? Because people had found gold in South Dakota, in the what hills are those called? The Black Hills. That's right. If there had been no gold there, there probably would have been no battle there. An abundance of fresh water. We never had the problems of the desert the way so many other countries have in the history of the world. Two very long sea coasts, and so on.
Could you turn off the color display behind you?
Is that bothering you?
Yeah.
Okay. There has been, for example, throughout American history, an isolationist element in our politics. Well, you can have an isolationist element if you are a country that is bounded on both sides by immense oceans. You can't be an isolationist in Liechtenstein or in Belgium or in the Netherlands, because you're cheek to jowl with much bigger countries who have designs on the things you have. Fundamental to American politics is its geography. And there are very few countries in the world that possess at one and the same time immense grasslands, high mountains, huge rivers, arid deserts, extremities of temperature, cold and hot. Certainly none of the countries in the ancient Near East had that experience. You can see that they are all of one piece. They're all together. Whatever happens is going to affect everybody sooner or later, and so on. Now, the great empires of the ancient Near East during biblical times, as you know, were Egypt, which really enjoyed hegemony in the ancient Near Eastern world for 3,000 years. we're beginning to wonder if ours is slipping away after 250. Egypt had it for 3,000. It's a completely inept country today. Absolutely hopeless. But at one time, it ruled this part of the world. And then Assyria, which is up here at Nineveh, Babylon, and Persia. What, anybody remember the capital of Persia? The Persian Empire, Cyrus, Darius. Susa was the capital. Here is Susa. Here is Babylon. Here is Nineveh up on the Tigris River. By the way, Dura Europus, anybody know why that name has become significant again? It was in Dura Europus that archaeologists uncovered what may be the earliest church building that we have ever, Christian church building that we have ever known anything about. They think it was a converted house. It had two basic rooms. One was the sanctuary and one was the baptistry. It's a fascinating story, but here's Dura Europus. But notice what we said before, the significance of the desert. It simply cut off all of this world from one another. So no wonder the prophets of the Old Testament are always talking about an enemy coming from the north. Why would they be worried about the north? Because everything was north so far as the direction in which anyone would take to get to Israel. You're going to go this way and you're going to come down this way. And it's always from the north that the attacker comes, never from the east, because nobody could make it across that much desert safely. And no wonder Israel spent her declining years constantly attempting an alliance with one of the great powers or the other. The prophets are constantly excoriating her for putting her trust in these diplomatic relationships rather than in the Lord. But here she is, and here they are, on both sides of her. All right, now we'll move to Israel. Okay, let's see if we can make this just a little bit bigger. Well, not too much bigger. Well, I spent about 4 hours figuring this out yesterday afternoon. Now, this is modern Israel, so it has Tel Aviv on it, for example. Tel Aviv does not figure in biblical history at all. It's an entirely modern city. Not a particularly attractive city. Here is Haifa, which is the biblical Joppa, rather than Haifa. Here is Gaza, and here is the Gaza Strip, which has caused so much trouble in world politics for a long time. Let me bring that down just a little bit more so you can see further up. Yeah, okay. There is no Caesarea Philippi any longer, so they've mixed together biblical locations with modern ones and modern names. Beersheba sits in the middle of a very deserty area, but now you drive and get closer, and suddenly there's a city with high rises and so on. That's what the Israelis have done. There are four regions, and these fundamentally affect the story that you read in the Bible. The first is the very flat coastal plain. How many of you have actually been to the Holy Land and have flown into Tel Aviv, as everybody does? There's only one international airport in Israel. You come in, and it is as flat as a pancake. And you come in over the water and you land in the airport just a few feet beyond the beach. It's all very flat. But almost right away, within 6 or 7 miles, you're starting to ascend in these rolling hills and then the foothills of the central mountain spine. Those foothills are called in Hebrew the Shephelah. Some of the English translations of the Bible actually use the transliteration of the Hebrew word Shephelah to describe those foothills that separate the coastal plain from the mountain ridge. It was in the foothills that much of the fighting took place in the War of Independence in 1948. Then you come to the central mountain ridge, and then crossing that, you descend very steeply into the Jordan Valley. Anybody know what geographically this is called? This is called the Great Rift. It's the same rift that you get down further south in Ethiopia, where you have the Rift Valley. This is, of course, as you know, the Dead Sea is the deepest surface location on the face of the earth, 1,500 feet below sea level. When Florence and I first visited the Holy Land, we spent some days in Jerusalem, having taken a shuttle from the airport to Jerusalem, being somewhat surprised ourselves at how little time it took to get from the airport to Jerusalem, less than an hour. Then we knew we had other things to see, so we went back to the airport and picked up our rental car. And we went from the airport in Tel Aviv, right by Jerusalem, and then down the highway to Qumran, which is at the northern end of the Dead Sea. The trip didn't take us an hour from here to here, and we didn't know where we were going, and it still didn't take us an hour. And Jerusalem sits at about 2,500 feet, and from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea, which lies at 1,500 feet below sea level, so you've dropped 4,000 feet, it takes you about 20 minutes. That's how steep the decline actually is. The road that features in the story of the Good Samaritan, the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, which is no longer used, but you can still see where it is, that was a steep climb for someone coming up from Jericho. It was an easy trip down for someone walking from Jerusalem to Jericho. It's fertile in the north. Here's Mount Hermon. Lots of water collects on Mount Hermon. And so you have biblical references to the dew of Hermon and the springs and so on. Caesarea Philippi is something of a resort because of the springs that come out of the hills at that particular place. It became later a Roman site, and temples to Pan were built there, and not least because people could come and enjoy the waters as well as do their worship of Pan. Here is sort of a transitional area, and then down here it is very, very dry. On Masada, which is above the Dead Sea, about halfway down, this tremendous fortress that Herod, who was an immensely avid builder, Herod built partly out of plans for making people realize how great he was, but also as a fortress. Herod was paranoid the last 10-15 years of his life. He was literally mentally ill. He had two of his sons executed because he feared that they had designs on his throne. And so the story of his attempting to kill the babies in Bethlehem fits perfectly into the Herod biographical narrative. Well, in Masada, you're on the top of a 2,000-foot peak, It's really a mesa with a flat top. And up there were provisions made for lots of people, at least to stay for a while. There were baths, public baths. There were fancy homes. There were several palaces. There were storerooms. Some of them have been excavated, and some of them have been left on purpose by the Israelis for the next generation to excavate. There will always be something to be discovered at Masada in generations to come. That's the plan. We're not going to do it all. We're going to leave some for the next generation, some. And if you remember, Masada figured in the Jewish war. When the war was lost, Jerusalem had fallen, some Jews, not a very large number of them, but some zealots, fled to Masada and camped on the top. It's a fortress almost impossible to reach if it is guarded, and it was guarded by several hundred Jewish fighters. Masada is right in here. And the Romans, determined to wipe out not only the present rebellion but any future rebellions, 10% of the Roman treasury at the time of the Jewish rebellion, 10% of the Roman treasury was being spent in Israel, just keeping the Israelis under control. And there was a tremendous amount of political resentment about that. And so when the Israelis revolted, the Romans responded furiously and wanting to fix this problem once and for all, which they did. They destroyed Jerusalem. They leveled the temple. And they were not going to let a small group of zealots alone. So they camped soldiers on both sides of the Masada summit, in the valley on both sides. Very steep walls. Those of you who have known, you can now get there with a cable car, but it is a rite of passage for most Israelis and for most world Jews who will travel at some point or another to Israel and will certainly go to Masada. It's something of a rite of passage to make the climb to the top along the switchback path and to be at Masada on a sunrise. In fact, they will even talk about the Masada in their own lives, by which they mean some particular crisis, some particular point at which they have to demonstrate their loyalty to Judaism and Israel and so on.
Pastor,
yeah.
How did they get water up there?
That's all of this is an introduction to the answer to that question. when you only get 2 inches of water a year, how can you hold out for more than 2 years as these people did? And the answer is they were clever engineers, and every bit of the 2 inches that fell on the top of that massive, that mesa, they collected and they stored. Cisterns can be found at virtually every tell. Tell is just the old Hebrew word for hill. And most towns became hills. The reason anybody put the town there in the first place was because there was a source of water and because it could be protected, it could be defended. So the next time, once that town had been destroyed by some enemy and someone came along and said, well, it's time to build a new town, they put it in exactly the same place for exactly the same 2 reasons. There was water there and it was a place that could be defended. And what happened through the ages is that the town was built upon the ruins of the previous version and then upon the ruins of the previous version of that and that and that. So every one of these is a hill. And archaeologists begin digging through, getting to the levels that lie beneath. And one of the interesting things about Israel's geography is you can go through the Byzantine period down to the Roman period, down to the Greek period, and then back into the Iron Age and so on as you go down. In any case, storing water became an engineering art. in Israel because water was in short supply, especially in the southern half of the country, and because it was not reliable. Some years it rained a lot, some years it didn't. So they needed to store every inch that they got. And there are a number of cisterns and some immense cisterns on the top of Masada. So you had water for baths. You had water for drinking. You had water for fountains even. But of course they continued to reuse that water. That's how clever they were about water storage. So those zealots could last for more than 2 years on the top of Masada. And while the Romans used Jewish slave labor to build this immense ramp of dirt and rock from the west side of Masada up. And so the zealots were just watching their enemy get closer and closer. They couldn't fire on the people who were building the ramp because they were fellow Jews. And Romans were not dumb, and they spent 2 years, and today, still today, you could walk up the ramp. And they knew that they were going to die. They knew that once the ramp got to the top, there was no way they were going to prevent the Roman army from getting them. There were thousands of them, and only a couple hundred of them. And so just before the Romans broke through, they all committed suicide together. So that's Masada in the history of Israel in the early 70s of the first century. So it's fertile to the north. It's dry in the south. One of Ben-Gurion's great dreams was to make the desert bloom. He talked a lot about making the desert bloom. And the kibbutz that he loved and where he settled before he... David Ben-Gurion is the George Washington of Israel. And he and his wife are buried at Sedeh Boker, which is a Negev kibbutz. And you make a pilgrimage. As an Israeli, you make a pilgrimage like we would make a pilgrimage to Washington, D.C., to Lincoln's tomb. They go to Sedeh Boker and sit around the graves of David Ben-Gurion and his wife. When we want to honor the dead in a cemetery, we bring flowers. Flowers, however, require a lot of water. No flowers on the Ben-Gurion tombs. They put little rocks on them instead as their way of a personal tribute to the founder of modern Israel. The dry south and the Negev account, and from here on, account for a lot of biblical references. Take, for example, Ezekiel 47. You remember in the last 8 chapters of Ezekiel, actually 9, you finally have the prophecy of Israel's restoration and her eventual salvation. And in those prophecies, you find the one in chapter 47, and you remember how it works. Ezekiel sees water coming out from under the floor of the temple. And it's beginning to flow down out of the city of Jerusalem and out down the valley. And the further it goes, the deeper it gets. At first, it's just wetting your feet. And then it's up to your knees. And then finally, it's up at your waist. And then finally, nobody can walk in the river, but could only swim because it's deeper than the height of your body. And then it flows down from Jerusalem to the Dead Sea. And because there is so much water, it makes that water sweet. And in verse 10 of chapter 47, we read... Well, let's say this water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah. This is the Arabah, this very dry central area. And enters the sea, it means the Dead Sea. When the water flows into the sea, the water will become fresh. And wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live, and there will be very many fish. For this water goes there, that the waters of the sea may become fresh, so everything will live where the river goes. Fishermen will stand beside the sea from En Gedi to En Eglaim. It will be a place for the spreading of nets. Its fish will be of many kinds, like the fish of the Great Sea, which is the Mediterranean. For someone who lives in the dry part of the world, water is a typical metaphor for blessing and for provision, because water was everything for them. So here is a picture of the final age, the messianic age of salvation, the Dead Sea, which is dead, dead, dead. The only thing that lives in the Dead Sea are some very, very strange microbes that you can find in some of the little ponds of water on the edge of the actual sea. There hasn't been a fish in there for thousands of years. You'd have to be a fish that survives on eating chemicals, basically. And so this image of water coming from Jerusalem, making the Dead Sea fresh, and suddenly fishermen lining the banks of the sea, is an image of not only fundamental transformation, but where death has prevailed, now life will follow it. Israel, as you can see there, is a small country, 65 miles from here to here. And that accounts for a lot of things that you read in the Bible. You can walk, and people did walk to most places in Israel in biblical times. The three pilgrimage feasts assumed that people anywhere in Israel could walk to Jerusalem, and they could. Mary and Joseph, of course, made the trip from Galilee to Bethlehem in order to pay their taxes. It is, by the way, the size of the country and its and the access to water that explains why the numbers we get in the Bible are almost certainly not to be taken literally. 2 million people did not come out of Israel at the Exodus. There is no place in the Sinai where you could find water in one spot sufficient for 2 million people. There are a lot of other reasons for knowing that ancient Near Eastern numbers are not intended to be taken literally. There are different theories about exactly what the numbers meant and how they should be understood. One of them is that it's just typical ancient Near Eastern hyperbole. Everything was exaggerated. People knew, we do that all the time too. I've told you 1,000 times not to do this or something. It's either hyperbole. Sometimes scholars would say it's probably hyperbole with a factor of 10. So if you had 2 million people, you'd be down to 200,000 people. Although that's probably high for the number of Israelites who came out of Egypt at the Exodus. The other is that we've misunderstood the Hebrew word aleph, which means thousand. Maybe it's a technical term that simply means a group of whatever particular size. You had this many groups. I'm not saying that the Bible is an error. I'm just saying we're learning to read it more accurately with respect to the conventions of ancient Near Eastern literature. For example, if you do all the adding up and multiplying and so on with the information you're given in the first chapters of Numbers, the result is that every Israelite mother had 51 children. I think we're probably not intended to believe that every Israelite mother on average had 51 children. So for example, all the towns and villages of ancient Israel, as you see them now in archaeological sites, were small, very small by our standards. The city of Jerusalem, the old city, has walls that are from the medieval period, so they don't precisely represent the size of the city of Jerusalem in the first century. When it was at its height, it was a huge city by ancient standards, 25,000 people or so. But people live together. You can walk from the Damascus Gate in the north to the Jaffa Gate in the south of the city of Jerusalem. You can walk across the entire old city of Jerusalem today in about 5 minutes at a brisk pace. So we're not talking about Manhattan. We're not talking about Chicago. We're talking about cities that were very small and their population quite small by our standards today. It also explains why the blessings of God on Israel at the time of David and Solomon were so extraordinary. You have this tiny little country sitting between Egypt and Assyria and Babylon and Persia, and yet it ruled the roost for a very short period of time. And then it explains why in the years that followed, the prophets were continuing to condemn the Israelites for seeking their safety in political alliances with one empire or the other. They were just small potatoes, and these empires were capable of just sweeping them off the face of the map. Its location also accounts for the presence of the story of famine and drought in the Bible, whether the one that caused Jacob and his sons to go to Egypt, or the one that occurred during Ahab's day, there is not enough water. So if you have a bad year or two of rains, you go hungry in this part of the world. You always did go hungry. Famine was a present threat to everyone's life and welfare because they depended so dramatically on the rain. There was no Nile like there was in Egypt, always to be relied on to bring life and crops and so on. Then you've got this part. You know, the Israelites crossed here opposite Jericho, and they're talking all the time about a land of milk and honey. They also had lions, though they were eventually eliminated. No lions have been there for centuries. But and that's also true, it was a much more forested land before Israel got there. Much of that forest was chopped down eventually, and there's comparatively little of it left. But its agricultural produce was exactly what you would expect from topography and geography like this. So they had some grains, not a huge amount of grain, but enough for a small population, barley and wheat primarily. They had grapes, they had figs, they had olives. They have all the things that grow in a hot, dry climate. And its animal husbandry, especially goats and sheep, was typical likewise of that land. And that leaves its mark on virtually every page of the Bible. If the Bible had been written in North America, the 23rd Psalm would not begin, "The Lord is my shepherd." But in the in biblical times, sheep were the primary livestock, so that made perfect sense. It was a land of shepherds. And then you have the same thing. You have the frequency of wine as an image of God's blessing, as in the blessing of Judah by Jacob at the end of his life. Judah becomes the heir, the ancestor of the Messiah, and talks about the kingdom that's going to come from him. There's going to be so much wine you can wash your clothes in it. There's going to be so much wine you can tie up the donkey to the vine. You wouldn't ordinarily do that because the donkey would eat the grapes. And the point is there are going to be so many grapes, you can let the animals eat their fill.
I'm going to add to this, but when Jesus crosses over and he heals the man who has a legion of demons,
right,
and all these pigs,
yeah,
and is the geography different that they can cultivate pigs there?
No, the difference is there is a scholar who spent his life in the Middle East. And Mike, do you remember what his name is? He's written books on the parables. He spent his life teaching in Lebanon. He's more modern than that. But I remember a statement he made in one of his books that the Middle East has never, ever been able somehow or another to accept the pig. Muslims don't eat pork either. These people, because they ate pigs, would have been thought of as really crude people, which is why the parable takes on the significance it does, because the Lord it's one of the very few moments in the Lord's ministry when he actually has a ministry to Gentiles rather than to Jews. In any case, the pig is not, the pig could be a part of this world, but it never really has been for a long time. Yeah. Okay. And then, So I want to leave a little bit of time for questions, but what I wanted to demonstrate to you is that the world in which all of this history takes place shapes that history in profound ways. And the fact that the Bible is so much a book of ancient Near Eastern history, I don't know if you appreciate, here is a book that demands that we take it to be true in what it says. And yet here is a book that inserts itself into the actual historical record of the ancient Near East. Again and again and again and again. It should be the easiest thing in the world to prove that the Bible has made a mistake in something it says about this empire or that empire, this king or that king, and so on. And there are certainly people who say that some of the biblical statements are untrue, but the fact of the matter is there is not a statement in the Bible that has ever been demonstrated to be untrue. And there are people, both believers and unbelievers in the world of scholarship, who will rise to the defense of the Bible in regard to any number of those statements that others have argued can't be true. So here you have a story, the story of salvation, that is situated in the very center of biblical history and in the very center of a particular part of the world. This is the world, actually the first map we saw. This is the world from which we get the first written history. Assyria has its historical records. When the Library of Ashurbanipal was discovered, there are all kinds of pieces of information gathered about Assyrian history and about Assyrian culture and Assyrian life. Same thing with Babylon, same thing with Persia. And here is Israel right in the midst of that history. And I think the number now of individual human beings who are mentioned in the Bible and are known to have existed from other ancient Near Eastern materials is 52. We know 52 individuals who are mentioned by name in the Bible and mentioned by name in other historical materials. Now, you have the same kind of thing in the New Testament as well. We have the name of emperors, we have the name of governors, and so on. And most of those names have been confirmed from Greco-Roman historical sources. And the same thing is true of the Bible, and it's part of its historicity that it is as profoundly shaped by its geography and topography as it has been. All right, comments or questions on this?
I heard a lecture similar to this, and they said they took a boundary of the desert, and they just put water to it. They didn't plant anything. And from an airplane, you could see green and vegetation just by putting water to that area.
Hugely significant. Actually, if you travel, as I do every summer, the Intermountain West between the Rockies and the Sierra Nevada, I think most environmentalists do not understand this. If you don't have cheap water, if you can't fertilize crops in the Intermountain West, it all goes back to scrub. Everything that's green in the Intermountain West is contoured. It's either in a big circle, or it's you know, whatever it is that the irrigating devices, however they move, that's where the green is. We have what they don't have, which is an abundance of water, and it makes possible a fertility where otherwise you would not have it. That was grazing land for, not even for buffalo. They stayed pretty much on the Great Plains where there was much more grass. That was grazing land for deer. You could put a cow on it, but you'd need 5 acres for every cow. So it's a hugely significant feature of our history as it is of ancient Near Eastern history. One of the fascinating things about the Israelis and the difference between them and the Arab world. I don't know how many of you ever read the Princeton, I always have trouble remembering his name, the Princeton, in those days he was called an Orientalist. When terrorism began to be the big story in American news, he was the one to which all the reporters turned. Bernard Lewis, that's right. And he wrote a fascinating book, What Went Wrong. And it's the demonstration of remarkable learning. One of the things Lewis says is that one of the reasons we don't know much about the Middle Eastern world is that in order to understand that world and that culture, you need to learn three languages. You need to learn Persian, you need to learn Turkish, and you need to learn Arabic. Three languages that Westerners simply have never made a practice of mastering. Bernard Lewis did. And the most arresting statistic in describing what has happened to Arab civilization is the fact that if you add up all the major Arab countries, not talking about Islamic countries, because there are more Muslims in Indonesia than there are in any Arab country, but if you add all the Arab countries together, and those are some big countries, you've got Egypt, and you have Iraq, and you have Iran, you have Syria, Turkey, the total measure of their exports to the rest of the world, if you take out fossil fuels, if you take out oil and gas, the total measure of the Arab world's export to the rest of the world is the same as Finland's. All these great countries, and they're producing nothing that the rest of the world is interested in. Egypt's biggest industry is what? Tourism. And tourism has been cut in 2/3 by the terrorism and the civil strife of the last some years. So here's Bernard Lewis, who's telling you that the problem with the Arab world is that it's inept. Well, at the top of the Dead Sea, right where Qumran is, right here, there is a fig kibbutz. You know, when kibbutzes were being, remember the original Israelis, the original Zionists, whether they got there long before independence or they got there immediately after independence, they were socialists. They all came from Central Europe and Russia. They were socialist in their politics and in their economics. And it was going to be a top-down economy run by the experts in the government. And so when a new group of Poles or Russians or Czechs, Jews somehow getting out of Europe after the Second World War or before, when they came to Israel, the government told them where they were going to live and what they were going to do. And each kibbutz had a particular function. Some would grow crops, some would make wine, some would run a hotel. There's a kibbutz on the Sea of Galilee that has been a tourist attraction for years and years and years. That was the job of the kibbutz. Well, at the top of the Red Sea, right on the side of the water, is a kibbutz that was a date palm orchard. Well, that dirt is poison. It's full of all the chemicals that kill everything in the water. And so how in the world are you going to plant trees in pure poison? Well, that's what the Israelis did. First of all, they picked up all the dirt, tons and tons and tons and tons of it. They washed it and cleaned it. Then they put the dirt back, and then they planted the trees. And one of the things that the guide will tell you is that this is exactly what the Israelis do. It's what the Arabs never do. Take those steps that have to be taken in order to make the land produce. Now, it comes with its, you know, when we were in Scotland in the 1970s, almost all the fresh food that we could buy in the grocery store in Aberdeen was coming from Israel. Oranges and lemons and cucumbers and all the rest.
Those glowing figs?
Yeah, that's right.
So it's interesting that you say that. When I was in Iraq, driving through the countryside, I was amazed at the amount of litter and garbage.
Oh, yeah.
Just the wind would blow, and anywhere you had a fence, it would just be lined with plastic bags. Yeah.
It's very depressing. We shouldn't suppose that it's only Arabs that do that. You find exactly the same thing in Greece. Athens was the dirtiest city I'd ever been in my life. Garbage everywhere. But and of course, yeah, some places in the United States too. In any case, one of the problems, of course, is that the Israelis have made the desert bloom, but they've done it at the expense of the water in the Jordan River. They've taken so much water out that so much less is getting into the Dead Sea that it's shrinking all the time. It's now only, it's about two-thirds of its size in the year 1900. So it's shrunk a third, and the number of acre feet has, of course, declined profoundly as the depth of the water has declined. But the Israelis being the Israelis, what they're planning to do is to pump water probably from the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, which is one of the arms off the Red Sea, and just pump that water back into the Dead Sea until it's back to its salt water anyway. I think in the ocean, isn't the level of salt about 5% of the volume of the water? It's something like that. In the Dead Sea, it's something like 33% of the water, which is why, like in the Great Salt Lake, you can float if you want to get into the water. You can float in those poisons. Yeah, well, it's below ocean level. It's not below the elevation of everything, both down and up, is measured from the surface of the oceans. That's simply what they decided to do, because that's where things naturally settle by gravity. And so for example, isn't it Mauna Loa or Mauna Kea that is the highest mountain in the world? It goes down to the bottom of the sea outside of Hawaii and then goes all the way to the top of its elevation above sea level. I think it's something like 35 or 36,000 feet, from the base to the top. Of course, we only see the top 12 or 11 or whatever thousands it is. But the reason it's salty is because of the nature of that deep rift. You've exposed a lot of the sulfur and the other elements that are usually buried underneath layers of topsoil. But here it's been exposed, and it affects the character of the water. All right.
Israel desalinating and getting plenty?
She is getting a good deal of her water now from desalinization, as are the Arab states on the Persian Gulf. Yeah, it's not the greatest water in the world, but it's an endless supply of it, and you can grow crops with desalinated water. I don't think so. It's very much the same sort of question you ask. When the time had fully come, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. Well, what exactly made that time the exact right time for the incarnation? The Bible doesn't ever actually answer that question, and we can't either. But on the other hand, if you were a citizen of Federal Way, and Russia was in Tacoma, and the United States was in Seattle, you would feel like somehow you were in the wrong place. And no doubt the Israelis thought the same thing. All right, thank you for your attention.